This is Audible.
Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, read by Mike Chamberlain. Preface to the Enlarged Edition. A Sand County Almanac was in draft form when Aldo Leopold died in 1948. His son Luna edited this material and saw it through to publication in 1949. He later prepared for publication another group of previously unpublished essays and journals, these appearing in 1953 under the title Round River. This new volume combines all of Sand County Almanac with 8 essays from Round River. The arrangement of the essays has been somewhat altered, and in one instance, 2 essays have been combined in order to avoid repetition and to present Aldo Leopold's central ideas in meaningful relationship to one another. Because of this rearrangement, the foreword to the original edition no longer describes the sections as they appear in this book. Part 2 has been renamed, Part 3 has become Part 4, and a new Part 3, made up mostly of essays from Round River, has been introduced. We have also made minor revisions in the text itself, where dated references served only to distract listeners. Though these essays have been widely read and quoted, their basic tenets have been all but forgotten in the glare of great national publicity extolling the virtues of natural beauty. Roadside beautification is a far cry from the harmony between man and land that Aldo Leopold knew and taught. The America that declares the preservation of natural beauty to be public policy is at the same time planning to build dams in 2 areas of great natural value. Bills are now before Congress to construct power dams in the Grand Canyon of the Colorado that would essentially kill the living river and flood a large part of this unique natural heritage. There also has been under construction for some years the construction of a dam for the development of hydroelectric power in Alaska at a location that would flood out a large portion of the breeding areas of the migratory waterfowl of the Pacific Coast. The construction of Rampart Dam could, in a moment of time, eliminate most of the ducks, geese, and other birds that each year for eons have passed over Washington, Oregon, and California. When Aldo Leopold wrote Goose Music, this could scarcely be imagined. Now this possibility is upon us. The shame is that the Americans proposing, agreeing to, and carrying out this plan will defend their action on financial grounds, when economics should not be the deciding factor, especially as alternative and feasible sources of electric power can be found. This generation of Aldo Leopold's grandchildren is rebelling on college campuses, demonstrating and working for social causes, and fighting on foreign soil. This same youth is maturing at that moment of time which is pivotal in the struggle to preserve things wild and free that Aldo Leopold understood so wisely and expressed so eloquently. Of all the causes that attract the attention of these young people, the plight of nature is one which may be truly a last call. Things wild and free are being destroyed by the impersonality of our attitude toward the land. What better way to fight the destruction of nature than to place in the hands of the young this powerful plea for a land ethic? Carolyn Clugston Leopold, Luna B. Leopold, Washington, D.C., June 1966. Foreword to Sand County Almanac. There are some who can live without wild things, and some who cannot. These essays are the delights and dilemmas of one who cannot. Like winds and sunsets, wild things were taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free. For us of the minority, the opportunity to see geese is more important than television, and the chance to find a pasque flower is a right as inalienable as free speech. These wild things, I admit, had little human value until mechanization assured us of a good breakfast, and until science disclosed the drama of where they come from and how they live. The whole conflict thus boils down to a question of degree. We of the minority see a law of diminishing returns in progress. Our opponents do not. One must make shift with things as they are. These essays are my shifts. They are grouped in three parts. Part one tells what my family sees and does at its weekend refuge from too much modernity, the shack. On this sand farm in Wisconsin, first worn out and then abandoned by our bigger and better society, we try to rebuild, with shovel and axe, what we are losing elsewhere. It is here that we seek, and still find, our meat from God. These shack sketches are arranged seasonally as a Sand County Almanac. Part two, sketches here and there, recounts some of the episodes in my life that taught me, gradually and sometimes painfully, that the company is out of step. These episodes, scattered over the continent and through 40 years of time, present a fair sample of the issues that bear the collective label, conservation. Part three, the upshot, sets forth, in more logical terms, some of the ideas whereby we dissenters rationalize our dissent. Only the very sympathetic listener will wish to wrestle with the philosophical questions of part three. I suppose it may be said that these essays tell the company how it may get back in step. Conservation is getting nowhere, because it is incompatible with our Abrahamic concept of land. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. There is no other way for land to survive the impact of mechanized man, nor for us to reap from it the aesthetic harvest it is capable of, under science, of contributing to culture. That land is a community is the basic concept of ecology, but that land is to be loved and respected is an extension of ethics. That land yields a cultural harvest is a fact long known, but latterly often forgotten. These essays attempt to weld these three concepts. Such a view of land and people is, of course, subject to the blurs and distortions of personal experience and personal bias. But wherever the truth may lie, this much is crystal clear. Our bigger and better society is now like a hypochondriac, so obsessed with its own economic health as to have lost the capacity to remain healthy. The whole world is so greedy for more bathtubs that it has lost the stability necessary to build them, or even to turn off the tap. Nothing could be more salutary at this stage than a little healthy contempt for a plethora of material blessings. Perhaps such a shift of values can be achieved by reappraising things unnatural, tame, and confined in terms of things natural, wild, and free. Aldo Leopold, Madison, Wisconsin, 4th March, 1948. Part 1. A Sand County Almanac. January. January thaw. Each year, after the midwinter blizzards, there comes a night of thaw when the tinkle of dripping water is heard in the land. It brings strange stirrings, not only to creatures abed for the night, but to some who have been asleep for the winter. The hibernating skunk, curled up in his deep den, uncurls himself and ventures forth to prowl the wet world, dragging his belly in the snow. His track marks one of the earliest datable events in that cycle of beginnings and ceasings which we call a year. The track is likely to display an indifference to mundane affairs uncommon at other seasons. It leads straight across country, as if its maker had hitched his wagon to a star and dropped the reins. I follow, curious to deduce his state of mind and appetite, and destination, if any. The months of the year, from January up to June, are a geometric progression in the abundance of distractions. In January, one may follow a skunk track, or search for bands on the chickadees, or see what young pines the deer have browsed, or what muskrat houses the mink have dug, with only an occasional and mild digression into other doings. January observation can be almost as simple and peaceful as snow, and almost as continuous as cold. There is time not only to see who has done what, but to speculate why. A meadow mouse, startled by my approach, darts damply across the skunk track. Why is he abroad in daylight? Probably because he feels grieved about the thraw. Today, his maze of secret tunnels, laboriously chewed through the matted grass under the snow, are tunnels no more, but only paths exposed to public view and ridicule. Indeed, the thawing sun has mocked the basic premises of the microtine economic system. The mouse is a sober citizen who knows that grass grows in order that mice may store it as underground haystacks, and that snow falls in order that mice may build subways from stack to stack, supply, demand, and transport all neatly organized. To the mouse, snow means freedom from want and fear. A rough-legged hawk comes sailing over the meadow ahead. Now he stops, hovers like a kingfisher, and then drops like a feathered bomb into the marsh. He does not rise again, and I am sure he has caught, and is now eating, some worried mouse engineer who could not wait until night to inspect the damage to his well-ordered world. The rough leg has no opinion why grass grows, but he is well aware that snow melts in order that hawks may again catch mice. He came down out of the Arctic in the hopes of thaws, for to him a thaw means freedom from want and fear. The skunk track enters the woods and crosses a glade where the rabbits have packed down the snow with their tracks and mottled it with pinkish urinations. Newly exposed oak seedlings have paid for the thaw with their newly barked stems. Tufts of rabbit hair bespeak the year's first battles among the amorous bucks. Further on I find a bloody spot, encircled by a wide-sweeping arc of owl's wings. To this rabbit, the thaw brought freedom from want, but also a reckless abandonment of fear. The owl has reminded him that thoughts of spring are no substitute for caution. The skunk track leads on, showing no interest in possible food, and no concern over the rompings or retributions of his neighbors. I wonder what he has on his mind, what got him out of bed. Can one impute romantic motives to this corpulent fellow, dragging his ample belt line through the slush? Finally, the track enters a pile of driftwood and does not emerge. I hear the tinkle of dripping water among the logs, and I fancy the skunk hears it too. I turn homeward, still wondering. February. Good Oak. There are two spiritual dangers in not owning a farm. One is the danger of supposing that breakfast comes from the grocery, and the other that heat comes from the furnace. To avoid the first danger, one should plant a garden, preferably where there is no grocer to confuse the issue. To avoid the second, he should lay a split of good oak on the andirons, preferably where there is no furnace, and let it warm his shins while a February blizzard tosses the trees outside. If one has cut, split, hauled, and piled his own good oak, and let his mind work the while, he will remember much about where the heat comes from, and with a wealth of detail denied to those who spend the weekend in town astride a radiator. The particular oak now aglow on my andirons grew on the bank of the old emigrant road where it climbs the sandhill. The stump, which I measured upon felling the tree, has a diameter of 30 inches. It shows 80 growth rings, hence the seedling from which it originated must have laid its first ring of wood in 1865, at the end of the Civil War. But I know from the history of present seedlings that no oak grows above the reach of rabbits without a decade or more of getting girdled each winter and re-sprouting during the following summer. Indeed, it is all too clear that every surviving oak is the product either of rabbit negligence or of rabbit scarcity. Some day, some patient botanist will draw a frequency curve of oak birth years and show that the curve humps every 10 years, each hump originating from a low in the 10-year rabbit cycle, a fauna and flora by this very process of perpetual battle within and among species, achieve collective immortality. It is likely, then, that a low in rabbits occurred in the middle 60s, when my oak began to lay on annual rings, but that the acorn that produced it fell during the preceding decade, when the covered wagons were still passing over my road into the Great Northwest. It may have been the wash and wear of the emigrant traffic that bared this road bank, and thus enabled this particular acorn to spread its first leaves to the sun. Only one acorn in 1,000 ever grew large enough to fight rabbits. The rest were drowned at birth in the prairie sea. It is a warming thought that this one wasn't, and thus lived to garner 80 years of June sun. It is this sunlight that is now being released, through the intervention of my axe and saw, to warm my shack and my spirit through 80 gusts of blizzard. And with each gust, a wisp of smoke from my chimney bears witness, to whomsoever it may concern, that the sun did not shine in vain. My dog does not care where heat comes from, but he cares ardently that it come, and soon. Indeed, he considers my ability to make it come as something magical, for when I rise in the cold black pre-dawn and kneel shivering by the hearth making a fire, he pushes himself blandly between me and the kindling splits I have laid on the ashes, and I must touch a match to them by poking it between his legs. Such faith, I suppose, is the kind that moves mountains. There was a bolt of lightning that put an end to wood-making by this particular oak. We were all awakened, one night in July, by the thunderous crash. We realized that the bolt must have hit nearby, but, since it had not hit us, we all went back to sleep. Man brings all things to the test of himself, and this is notably true of lightning. Next morning, as we strolled over the sandhill, rejoicing with the coneflowers and the prairie clovers over their fresh accession of rain, we came upon a great slab of bark freshly torn from the trunk of the roadside oak. The trunk showed a long spiral scar of barkless sapwood, a foot wide and not yet yellowed by the sun. By the next day, the leaves had wilted, and we knew that the lightning had bequeathed to us 3 cords of prospective fuel wood. We mourned the loss of the old tree, but knew that a dozen of its progeny, standing straight and stalwart on the sands, had already taken over its job of woodmaking. We let the dead veteran season for a year in the sun it could no longer use, and then on a crisp winter's day, we laid a newly filed saw to its bastioned base. Fragrant little chips of history spewed from the saw cut, and accumulated on the snow before each kneeling sawyer. We sensed that these 2 piles of sawdust were something more than wood, that they were the integrated transect of a century, that our saw was biting its way, stroke by stroke, decade by decade, into the chronology of a lifetime, written in concentric annual rings of good oak. It took only 12 pulls of the saw to transect the few years of our ownership, during which we had learned to love and cherish this farm. Abruptly, we began to cut the years of our predecessor, the bootlegger, who hated this farm, skinned it of residual fertility, burned its farmhouse, threw it back into the lap of the county, with delinquent taxes to boot, and then disappeared among the landless anonymities of the Great Depression. Yet the oak had laid down good wood for him. His sawdust was as fragrant, as sound, and as pink as our own. An oak is no respecter of persons. The reign of the bootlegger ended sometime during the Dust Bowl droughts of 1936, 1934, 1933, and 1930. Oak smoke from his still and peat from burning marshlands must have clouded the sun in those years, and alphabetical conservation was abroad in the land, but the sawdust shows no change. "Rest," cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now our saw bites into the 1920s, the Babitian decade when everything grew bigger and better in heedlessness and arrogance, until 1929, when stock markets crumbled. If the oak heard them fall, its wood gives no sign, nor did it heed the legislature's several protestations of love for trees. A national forest and a forest crop law in 1927, a great refuge on the upper Mississippi bottomlands in 1924, and a new forest policy in 1921. Neither did it notice the demise of the state's last martin in 1925, nor the arrival of its first starling in 1923. In March 1922, the big sleet tore the neighboring elms limb from limb, but there is no sign of damage to our tree. What is a ton of ice, more or less, to a good oak? Rest, cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now the saw bites into 1910-20, the decade of the drainage dream, when steam shovels sucked dry the marshes of central Wisconsin to make farms and made ash heaps instead. Our marsh escaped, not because of any caution or forbearance among engineers, but because the river floods it each April, and did so with a vengeance, perhaps a defensive vengeance, in the years of 1913-16. The yolk laid on wood just the same, even in 1915, when the Supreme Court abolished the state forests, and Governor Philip pontificated that state forestry is not a good business proposition. It did not occur to the governor that there might be more than one definition of what is good, and even of what is business. It did not occur to him that while the courts were writing one definition of goodness in the law books, fires were writing quite another one on the face of the land. Perhaps, to be a governor, one must be free from doubt on such matters. While forestry receded during this decade, game conservation advanced. In 1916, pheasants became successfully established in Waukesha County. In 1915, a federal law prohibited spring shooting. In 1913, a state game farm was started. In 1912, a buck law protected female deer. In 1911, an epidemic of refuges spread over the state. Refuge became a holy word, but the oak took no heed. Rest, cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now we cut 1910, when a great university president published a book on conservation. A great sawfly epidemic killed millions of tamaracks. A great drought burned the pineries. And a great dredge drained Horicon Marsh. We cut 1909, when smelt were first planted in the Great Lakes, and when a wet summer induced the legislature to cut the forest fire appropriations. We cut 1908, a dry year when the forests burned fiercely, and Wisconsin parted with its last cougar. We cut 1907, when a wandering lynx, looking in the wrong direction for the promised land, ended his career among the farms of Dane County. We cut 1906, when the first state forester took office, and fires burned 17,000 acres in these sand counties. We cut 1905, when a great flight of goshawks came out of the north and ate up the local grouse. They no doubt perched in this tree to eat some of mine. We cut 1902-3, a winter of bitter cold. 1901, which brought the most intense drought of record, rainfall only 17 inches. 1900, a centennial year of hope, a prayer, and the usual annual ring of oak. Rest, cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now our saw bites into the 1890s, called gay by those whose eyes turn cityward rather than landward. We cut 1899, when the last passenger pigeon collided with a charge of shot near Babcock, two counties to the north. We cut 1898, when a dry fall, followed by a snowless winter, froze the soil 7 feet deep and killed the apple trees. 1897, another drought year, when another forestry commission came into being. 1896, when 25,000 prairie chickens were shipped to market from the village of Spooner alone. 1895, another year of fires. 1894, another drought year. And 1893, the year of the bluebird storm, when a March blizzard reduced the migrating bluebirds to near zero. The first bluebirds always alighted in this oak, but in the middle 90s, it must have gone without. We cut 1892, another year of fires. 1891, a low in the grouse cycle. And 1890, the year of the Babcock milk tester, which enabled Governor Heil to boast, half a century later, that Wisconsin is America's dairyland. The motor licenses, which now parade that boast, were then not foreseen, even by Professor Babcock. It was likewise in 1890 that the largest pine rafts in history slipped down the Wisconsin River in full view of my oak, to build an empire of red barns for the cows of the prairie states. Thus it is that good pine that now stands between the cow and the blizzard, just as good oak stands between the blizzard and me. "Rest," cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now our saw bites into the 1880s, into 1889, a drought year in which Arbor Day was first proclaimed, into 1887, when Wisconsin appointed its first game wardens, into 1886, when the College of Agriculture held its first short course for farmers, into 1885, preceded by a winter of unprecedented length and severity, into 1883, when Dean W. H. Henry reported that the spring flowers at Madison bloomed 13 days later than average, into 1882, the year Lake Mendota opened a month late following the historic big snow and bitter cold of 1881-2. It was likewise in 1881 that the Wisconsin Agricultural Society debated the question, how do you account for the second growth of black oak timber that has sprung up all over the country in the last 30 years? My oak was one of these. One debater claimed spontaneous generation. Another claimed regurgitation of acorns by southbound pigeons. "Rest," cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Now our saw bites the 1870s, the decade of Wisconsin's carousal in wheat. Monday morning came in 1879, when cinch bugs, grubs, rust, and soil exhaustion finally convinced Wisconsin farmers that they could not compete with the virgin prairies further west in the game of weeding land to death. I suspect that this farm played its share in the game, and that the sand blow just north of my oak had its origin in overweeding. The same year of 1879 saw the first planting of carp in Wisconsin, and also the first arrival of quackgrass as a stowaway from Europe. On 27th October 1879, six migrating prairie chickens perched on the roof tree of the German Methodist Church in Madison and took a look at the growing city. On 8th November, the markets at Madison were reported to be glutted with ducks at 10 cents each. In 1878, a deer hunter from Sauk Rapids remarked prophetically, "The hunters promised to outnumber the deer." On 10th September 1877, two brothers, shooting Muskego Lake, bagged 210 blue-winged teal in one day. In 1876 came the wettest year of record. The rainfall piled up 50 inches. Prairie chickens declined, perhaps owing to hard rains. In 1875, four hunters killed 153 prairie chickens at York Prairie, one county to the eastward. In the same year, the U.S. Fish Commission planted Atlantic salmon in Devil's Lake, 10 miles south of my oak. In 1874, the first factory-made barbed wire was stapled to oak trees. I hope no such artifacts are buried in the oak now under saw. In 1873, one Chicago firm received and marketed 25,000 prairie chickens. The Chicago trade collectively bought 600,000 at $3.25 per dozen. In 1872, the last wild Wisconsin turkey was killed, two counties to the southwest. It is appropriate that the decade ending the pioneer carousal in wheat should likewise have ended the pioneer carousal in pigeon blood. In 1871, within a 50-mile triangle spreading northwestward from my oak, 136 million pigeons are estimated to have nested, and some may have nested in it, for it was then a thrifty sapling 20 feet tall. Pigeon hunters by scores plied their trade with net and gun, club and salt lick, and trainloads of prospective pigeon pie moved southward and eastward toward the cities. It was the last big nesting in Wisconsin, and nearly the last in any state. This same year, 1871, brought other evidence of the march of empire. The Peshtigo Fire, which cleared a couple of counties of trees and soil, and the Chicago Fire, said to have started from the protesting kick of a cow. In 1870, the meadow mice had already staged their march of empire. They ate up the young orchards of the young state and then died. They did not eat my oak, whose bark was already too tough and thick for mice. It was likewise in 1870 that a market gunner boasted in the American Sportsman of killing 6,000 ducks in one season near Chicago. "Rest," cries the chief sawyer, and we pause for breath. Our saw now cuts the 1860s, when thousands died to settle the question, is the man-man community likely to be dismembered? They settled it, but they did not see, nor do we yet see, that the same question applies to the man-land community. This decade was not without its gropings toward the larger issue. In 1867, Increase A. Lapham introduced the State Horticulture Society to offer prizes for forest plantations. In 1866, the last native Wisconsin elk was killed. The saw now severs 1865, the pith year of our oak. In that year, John Muir offered to buy from his brother, who then owned the home farm 30 miles east of my oak, a sanctuary for the wildflowers that had gladdened his youth. His brother declined to part with the land, but he could not suppress the idea. 1865 still stands in Wisconsin history as the birth year of mercy for things natural, wild, and free. We have cut the core. Our saw now reverses its orientation in history. We cut backward across the years and outward toward the far side of the stump. At last there is a tremor in the great trunk. The saw kerf suddenly widens. The saw is quickly pulled as the sawyers spring backward to safety. All hands cry, "Timber!" My oak leans, groans, and crashes with earth-shaking thunder, to lie prostrate across the emigrant road that gave it birth. Now comes the job of making wood. The maul rings on steel wedges as the sections of trunk are upended one by one, only to fall apart in fragrant slabs to be corded by the roadside. There is an allegory for historians in the diverse functions of saw, wedge, and axe. The saw works only across the years, which it must deal with one by one in sequence. From each year, the raker teeth pull little chips of fact, which accumulate in little piles, called sawdust by woodsmen and archives by historians. Both judge the character of what lies within by the character of the samples thus made visible without. It is not until the transect is completed that the tree falls and the stump yields a collective view of a century. By its fall, the tree attests the unity of the hodgepodge called history. The wedge, on the other hand, works only in radial splits. Such a split yields a collective view of all the years at once, or no view at all, depending on the skill with which the plane of the split is chosen. If in doubt, let the section season for a year until a crack develops. Many a hastily driven wedge lies rusting in the woods, embedded in unsplittable cross-grain. The axe functions only at an angle diagonal to the ears, and this only for the peripheral rings of the recent past. Its special function is to lop limbs, for which both saw and wedge are useless. The three tools are requisite to good oak and to good history. These things I ponder as the kettle sings, and the good oak burns to red coals on white ashes. Those ashes, come spring, I will return to the orchard at the foot of the sandhill. They will come back to me again, perhaps as red apples, or perhaps as a spirit of enterprise in some fat October squirrel, who, for reasons unknown to himself, is bent on planting acorns. March. The geese return. One swallow does not make a summer, but one skein of geese, cleaving the murk of a March thaw, is the spring. A cardinal, whistling spring to a thaw, but later finding himself mistaken, can retrieve his error by resuming his winter silence. A chipmunk, emerging for a sunbath but finding a blizzard, has only to go back to bed. But a migrating goose, staking 200 miles of black night on the chance of finding a hole in the lake, has no easy chance for retreat. His arrival carries the conviction of a prophet who has burned his bridges. A March morning is only as drab as he who walks in it without a glance skyward, ear cocked for geese. I once knew an educated lady, banded by Phi Beta Kappa, who told me that she had never heard or seen the geese that twice a year proclaim the revolving seasons to her well-insulated roof. Is education possibly a process of trading awareness for things of lesser worth? The goose who trades his is soon a pile of feathers. The geese that proclaim the seasons to our farm are aware of many things, including the Wisconsin statutes. The southbound November flocks pass over us high and haughty, with scarcely a honk of recognition for their favorite sandbars and sloughs. As a crow flies, is crooked compared with their undeviating aim at the nearest big lake 20 miles to the south, where they loaf by day on broad waters and filch corn by night from the freshly cut stubbles. November geese are aware that every marsh and pond bristles from dawn till dark with hopeful guns. March geese are a different story. Although they have been shot at most of the winter, as attested by their buckshot-battered pinions, they know that the spring truce is now in effect. They wind the oxbows of the river, cutting low over the now gunless points and islands, and gabbling to each sandbar as to a long-lost friend. They weave low over the marshes and meadows, greeting each newly melted puddle and pool. Finally, after a few pro forma circlings of our marsh, they set wing and glide silently to the pond, black landing gear lowered and rumps white against the far hill. Once touching water, our newly arrived guests set up a honking and splashing that shakes the last thought of winter out of the brittle cattails. Our geese are home again. It is at this moment of each year that I wish I were a muskrat, eye deep in the marsh. Once the first geese are in, they honk a clamorous invitation to each migrating flock, and in a few days the marsh is full of them. On our farm, we measure the amplitude of our spring by 2 yardsticks, the number of pines planted, and the number of geese that stop. Our record is 642 geese counted in on 11 April 1946. As in fall, our spring geese makes daily trips to corn, but these are no surreptitious sneakings out by night. The flocks move noisily to and from corn stubbles through the day. Each departure is preceded by a loud gustatory debate, and each return by an even louder one. The returning flocks, once thoroughly at home, omit their pro forma circlings of the marsh. They tumble out of the sky like maple leaves, side-slipping right and left to lose altitude, feet spraddled toward the shouts of welcome below. I suppose the ensuing gabble deals with the merits of the day's dinner. They are now eating the waste corn that the snow blanket has protected over winter from corn-seeking crows, cottontails, meadow mice, and pheasants. It is a conspicuous fact that the corn stubbles selected by geese for feeding are usually those occupying former prairies. No man knows whether this bias for prairie corn reflects some superior nutritional value, or some ancestral tradition transmitted from generation to generation since the prairie days. Perhaps it reflects the simpler fact that prairie cornfields tend to be large. If I could understand the thunderous debates that precede and follow these daily excursions to corn, I might soon learn the reason for the prairie bias. But I cannot, and I am well content that it should remain a mystery. What a dull world if we knew all about geese! And thus watching the daily routine of a spring goose convention, one notices the prevalence of singles, lone geese that do much flying about and much talking. one is apt to impute a disconsolate tone to their honkings, and to jump to the conclusion that they are broken-hearted widowers or mothers hunting lost children. The seasoned ornithologist knows, however, that such subjective interpretation of bird behavior is risky. I long tried to keep an open mind on the question. After my students and I had counted for half a dozen years the number of geese comprising a flock, some unexpected light was cast on the meaning of lone geese. It was found by mathematical analysis that flocks of six or multiples of six were far more frequent than chance alone would dictate. In other words, goose flocks are families or aggregations of families, and lone geese in spring are probably just what our fond imaginings at first suggested. They are bereaved survivors of the winter's shooting, searching in vain for their kin. Now I am free to grieve with and for the lone honkers. It is not often that cold potato mathematics thus confirms the sentimental promptings of the bird lover. On April nights, when it has become warm enough to sit outdoors, we love to listen to the proceedings of the convention in the marsh. There are long periods of silence when one hears only the winnowing of snipe, the hoot of a distant owl, or the nasal clucking of some amorous coot. Then, of a sudden, a strident honk resounds, and in an instant, pandemonium echoes. There is a beating of pinions on water, a rushing of dark prows propelled by churning paddles, and a general shouting by the onlookers of a vehement controversy. Finally, some deep honker has his last word, and the noise subsides to that half-audible small talk that seldom ceases among geese. Once again, I would I were a muskrat. By the time the pasks are in full bloom, our goose convention dwindles, and before May, our marsh is once again a mere grassy wetness, enlivened only by red wings and rails. It is an irony of history that the great powers should have discovered the unity of nations at Cairo in 1943. The geese of the world have had that notion for a longer time, and each march they stake their lives on its essential truth. In the beginning, there was only the unity of the ice sheet, then following the unity of the March thaw and the northward hegira of the international geese. Every march since the Pleistocene, the geese have honked unity from China Sea to Siberian steppe, from Euphrates to Volga, from Nine to Murmansk, from Lincolnshire to Spitsbergen. Every march since the Pleistocene, the geese have honked unity from Currituck to Labrador, Matamiskeet to Ungava, Horseshoe Lake to Hudson's Bay, Avery Island to Baffin Land, Panhandle to Mackenzie, Sacramento to Yukon. By this international commerce of geese, the waste corn of Illinois is carried through the clouds of the Arctic tundras, there to combine with the waste sunlight of a nightless June to grow goslings for all the lands between. And in this annual barter of food for light and winter warmth for summer solitude, the whole continent receives as net profit a wild poem dropped from the murky skies upon the muds of March. April. Come high water. The same logic that causes big rivers always to flow past big cities causes cheap farms sometimes to be marooned by spring floods. Ours is a cheap farm, and sometimes when we visit it in April, we get marooned. Not intentionally, of course, but one can, to a degree, guess from weather reports when the snows up north will melt, and one can estimate how many days it takes for the flood to run the gauntlet of upriver cities. Thus, come Sunday evening, one must go back to town and work, but one can't. How sweetly the spreading waters murmur condolence for the wreckage they have inflicted on Monday morning dates. How deep and chesty the honkings of the geese as they cruise over cornfield after cornfield, each in process of becoming a lake. Every 100 yards, some new goose flails the air as he struggles to lead the echelon in its morning survey of this new and watery world. The enthusiasm of geese for high water is a subtle thing, and might be overlooked by those unfamiliar with goose gossip. But the enthusiasm of carp is obvious and unmistakable. No sooner has the rising flood wetted the grass roots than here they come, rooting and wallowing with a prodigious zest of pigs turned out to pasture, flashing red tails and yellow bellies, cruising the wagon tracks and cow paths, and shaking the reeds and bushes in their haste to explore what to them is an expanding universe. Unlike the geese and the carp, the terrestrial birds and mammals accept high water with philosophical detachment. A cardinal atop a river birch whistles loudly his claim to a territory that, but for the trees, cannot be seen to exist. A ruffled grouse drums from the flooded woods. He must be perched on the high end of his highest drumming log. Meadow mice paddle ridgeward with the calm assurance of miniature muskrats. From the orchard bounds a deer, evicted from his usual daytime bed in the willow thickets. Everywhere are rabbits, calmly accepting quarters on our hill, which serves, in Noah's absence, for an ark. The spring flood brings us more than high adventure. It brings likewise an unpredictable miscellany of floatable objects pilfered from upriver farms. An old board stranded on our meadow has, to us, twice the value of the same piece new from the lumberyard. Each old board has its own individual history, always unknown, but always to some degree guessable from the kind of wood, its dimensions, its nails, screws, or paint, its finish or the lack of it, its wear or decay. One can even guess, from the abrasion of its edges and ends on sandbars, how many floods have carried it in years past. Our lumber pile, recruited entirely from the river, is thus not only a collection of personalities, but an anthology of human strivings in upriver farms and forests. The autobiography of an old board is a kind of literature not yet taught on campuses, but any riverbank farm is a library where he who hammers or saws may read at will. Come high water, there is always an accession of new books. There are degrees and kinds of solitude. An island in a lake has one kind, but lakes have boats, and there is always the chance that one might land to pay you a visit. A peak in the clouds has another kind, but most peaks have trails, and trails have tourists. I know of no solitude so secure as one guarded by a spring flood, nor do the geese, who have seen more kinds and degrees of aloneness than I have. So we sit on our hill beside a new-blown pask and watch the geese go by. I see our road dipping gently into the waters, and I conclude, with inner glee but exterior detachment, that the question of traffic, in or out, is for this day at least debatable only among carp. Dreba. Within a few weeks now, Dreba, the smallest flower that blows, will sprinkle every sandy place with small blooms. He who hopes for spring, with upturned eye, never sees so small a thing as Dreba. He who despairs of spring, with downcast eye, steps on it, unknowing. He who searches for spring, with his knees in the mud, finds it in abundance. Dreba asks, and gets, but scant allowance of warmth and comfort. It subsists on the leavings of unwanted time and space. Botany books give it two or three lines, but never a plate or portrait. Sand too poor and sun too weak for bigger, better blooms are good enough for Dreba. After all, it is no spring flower, but only a postscript to a hope. Dreba plucks no heartstrings. Its perfume, if there is any, is lost in the gusty winds. Its color is plain white. Its leaves wear a sensible woolly coat. Nothing eats it. It is too small. No poets sing of it. Some botanist once gave it a Latin name and then forgot it. Altogether, it is of no importance, just a small creature that does a small job quickly and well. Burr oak. When school children vote on a state bird, flower, or tree, they are not making a decision. They are merely ratifying history. Thus, history made burr oak the characteristic tree of southern Wisconsin when the prairie grasses first gained possession of the region. Burr oak is the only tree that can stand up to a prairie fire and live. Have you ever wondered why a thick crust of corky bark covers the whole tree, even to the smallest twigs? This cork is armor. Burr Oaks were the shock troops sent by the invading forest to storm the prairie. Fire is what they had to fight. Each April, before the new grasses had covered the prairie with unburnable greenery, fires ran at will over the land, sparing only such old oaks as had grown bark too thick to scorch. Most of these groves of scattered veterans, known to the pioneers as oak openings, consisted of burr oaks. Engineers did not discover insulation. They copied it from these old soldiers of the Prairie War. Botanists can read the story of that war for 20,000 years. The record consists partly of pollen grains embedded in peats, partly of relic plants interned in the rear of the battle and there forgotten. The record shows that the forest front, at times, retreated almost to Lake Superior. At times, it advanced far to the south. At one period, it advanced so far southward that spruce and other rear guard species grew to and beyond the southern border of Wisconsin. Spruce pollen appears at a certain level in all peat bogs of the region. But the average battle line between prairie and forest was about where it is now, and the net outcome of the battle was a draw. One reason for this was that there were allies that threw their support first to one side, then to the other. Thus, rabbits and mice mowed down the prairie herbs in summer, and in winter girdled any oak seedlings that survived the fires. Squirrels planted acorns in fall and ate them all the rest of the year. June beetles undermined the prairie sod in their grub stage, but defoliated the oaks in their adult stage. But for this geeing and hawing of allies, and hence of the victory, we should not have today that rich mosaic of prairie and forest soils which looks so decorative on a map. Jonathan Carver has left us a vivid word picture of the prairie border in pre-settlement days. On 10th October 1763, he visited Blue Mounds, a group of high hills, now wooded, near the southwestern corner of Dane County. He says, "I ascended one of the highest of these and had an extensive view of the country. For many miles, nothing was to be seen but lesser mountains, which appeared at a distance like haycocks, they being free from trees. Only a few groves of hickory and stunted oaks covered some of the valleys." In the 1840s, a new animal, the settler, intervened in the prairie battle. He didn't mean to. He just plowed enough fields to deprive the prairie of its immemorial ally, fire. Seedling oaks forthwith romped over the grasslands in legions, and what had been the prairie region became a region of woodlot farms. If you doubt this story, go count the rings on any set of stumps on any ridge woodlot in southwest Wisconsin. All the trees except the oldest veterans date back to the 1850s and the 1860s, and this was when fires ceased on the prairie. John Muir grew up in Marquette County during this period when new woods overrode the old prairies and engulfed the oak openings in thickets of saplings. In his boyhood and youth, he recalls that the uniformly rich soil of the Illinois and Wisconsin prairies produced so close and tall a growth of grasses for fires that no tree could live on it. Had there been no fires, these fine prairies, so marked a feature of the country, would have been covered by the heaviest forest. As soon as the oak openings were settled and the farmers had prevented running grass fires, the grubs, roots, grew up into trees and formed tall thickets so dense that it was difficult to walk through them, and every trace of the sunny oak openings vanished. Thus, he who owns a veteran burr oak owns more than a tree. He owns a historical library and a reserved seat in the theater of evolution. To the discerning eye, his farm is labeled with the badge and symbol of the Prairie War. Skydance. I owned my farm for 2 years before learning that the Skydance is to be seen over my woods every evening in April and May. Since we discovered it, my family and I have been reluctant to miss even a single performance. The show begins on the first warm evening in April at exactly 6:50 p.m. The curtain goes up 1 minute later each day until 1st June, when the time is 7:50. This sliding scale is dictated by vanity, the dancer demanding a romantic light intensity of exactly 0.05 foot candles. Do not be late, and sit quietly, lest he fly away in a huff. The stage props, like the opening hour, reflect the temperamental demands of the performer. The stage must be an open amphitheater in woods or brush, and in its center there must be a mossy spot, a streak of sterile sand, a bare outcrop of rock, or a bare roadway. Why the male woodcock should be such a stickler for a bare dance floor puzzled me at first, but I now think it is a matter of legs. The woodcock's legs are short, and his struttings cannot be executed to advantage in dense grass or weeds, nor could his lady see them there. I have more woodcocks than most farmers, because I have more mossy sand, too poor to support grass. Knowing the place and the hour, you seat yourself under a bush to the east of the dance floor and wait, watching against the sunset for the woodcock's arrival. He flies in low from some neighboring thicket, alights on the bare moss, and at once begins the overture, a series of queer throaty peents spaced about 2 seconds apart, and sounding much like the summer call of the nighthawk. Suddenly the peenting ceases, and the bird flutters skyward in a series of wide spirals, emitting a musical twitter. Up and up he goes, the spirals steeper and smaller, the twittering louder and louder, until the performer is only a speck in the sky. Then, without warning, he tumbles like a crippled plane, giving voice in a soft liquid warble that a March bluebird might envy. At a few feet from the ground, he levels off and returns to his peenting ground, usually to the exact spot where the performance began, and there resumes his peenting. It is soon too dark to see the bird on the ground, but you can see his flights against the sky for an hour, which is the usual duration of the show. On moonlight nights, however, it may continue, at intervals, as long as the moon continues to shine. At daybreak, the whole show is repeated. In early April, the final curtain falls at 5:15 a.m. The time advances 2 minutes a day until June, when the performance closes for the year at 3:15. Why the disparity in sliding scale? Alas, I fear that even romance tires, for it takes only a fifth as much light to stop the sky dance at dawn as suffices to start it at sunset. It is fortunate, perhaps, that no matter how intently one studies the hundred little dramas of the woods and meadows, one can never learn all of the salient facts about any one of them. What I do not yet know about the sky dance is, where is the lady, and just what part, if any, does she play? I often see two woodcocks on a peenting ground, and the two sometimes fly together, but they never peent together. Is the second bird the hen, or a rival male? Another unknown. Is the twitter vocal, or is it mechanical? My friend, Bill Feeney, once clapped a net over a peenting bird and removed his outer primary wing feathers. Thereafter the bird peented and warbled, but twittered no more. But one such experiment is hardly conclusive. Another unknown. Up to what stage of nesting does the male continue the sky dance? My daughter once saw a bird peenting within 20 yards of a nest containing hatched eggshells. But was this his lady's nest? Or is this secretive fellow possibly bigamous without our ever having found it out? These and many other questions remain mysteries of the deepening dusk. The drama of the sky dance is enacted nightly on hundreds of farms, the owners of which sigh for entertainment, but harbor the illusion that it is to be sought in theaters. They live on the land, but not by the land. The woodcock is a living refutation of the theory that the utility of a game bird is to serve as a target, or to pose gracefully on a slice of toast. No one would rather hunt woodcock in October than I. But since learning of the sky dance, I find myself calling one or two birds enough. I must be sure that, come April, there be no dearth of dancers in the sunset sky. May. Back from the Argentine. When dandelions have set the mark of May on Wisconsin pastures, It is time to listen for the final proof of spring. Sit down on a tussock, cock your ears at the sky, dial out the bed.